You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In October of 1977, David Bowman moved to Las Vegas as a 16-year-old kid with his parents and older brother. Bowman chronicles his journey through the streets of Las Vegas for the next 3 years. Bringing Down Colada, Bowman tells us how he worked his way into the most elite criminal organization in Las Vegas. He recounts how he became the point man in the Las Vegas Organized Crime Strike Force's investigation of the Chicago outfit and Tony Spilotro and his right-hand man, Frank Colada, the leader of the hole-in-the-wall gang. The book that we're featuring this evening is Bringing Down Colada, the story Casino couldn't tell you, with my special guest, author David Bowman. Welcome to the program, and thank you for this interview, David Bowman.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here. Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much. This is a very personal story, and let's get right to that. I won't ask how you got involved. That will be revealed as we go through this story. Why don't you take us back, as you do in the book, to 1977. Your dad was forced into retirement, and you got sick in the eighth grade. Tell us what happened in the eighth grade and who you were at that time and how things changed after that. Give us a little bit about your background, your family life, and as you do in the book, and what happened in that pivotal time just entering high school.
Yeah, I got sick with salmonella initially, and we couldn't determine where I'd got it from, but it ended up, it was our cat, our family cat. And but that developed into colitis, and I had to, you know, I was in really bad shape. I lost a lot of blood. I had to have 6 pints of blood transfused over the course of a couple of weeks. And so I ended up having to have emergency surgery, colostomy, temporary colostomy. And that was really, you know, devastating to me at the time. I mean, being in the eighth grade, you know, it was February is when I got sick. So I was into the school year, and, you know, I was very, you know, popular, athletic. You know, I was a editor of our little paper and school paper and whatnot. So I was just a healthy, normal kid. I was into racing dirt bikes, too. My friend was we were into that. And so, yeah, I got very sick. But once I had the surgery, you know, I recovered and pretty well bounced back to normal. But at that time, my dad had worked for the Colorado Fuel and Iron, the CF&I, steel plant in Pueblo. And at that time, in the late 70s, the Japanese steel was beginning to flood the cars. And so they were scaling the mill back, and he was pretty much forced into retirement. He either had to go back in the ranks, take a pay cut, or retire early and get his pension. And so that's what he did. And that was devastating to him. You know, he'd worked there for 32 years, and it was, you know, I really didn't understand it at the time, but as I got older, I realized, you know, how devastating that was to him. Because he was still pretty much a young man. And but anyway, we had gone out to Vegas in March of 77 and went out just on a vacation with me and my brother Larry and my folks. And we had a great time. We liked it. And we started talking about moving out there. And because Pueblo was really, it was kind of a dead-end place. There really wasn't a lot of opportunity, and my dad knew that, And so he thought, well, let's go out to Las Vegas. And so that's really how it happened. We left and went out there in October of 77.
Now, you talk about that your parents don't hang around so long, and you decide to hang around with your brother, and you get an apartment. They think that they're going to give you a little bit of money and that you're going to get a job and you're going to get this apartment, and that's what you're going to do. But you had other ideas, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd met some people. The reason they moved back was because my mother's my granddad was at the end of his life, and he needed a lot of you know, attention and care, and he was living with my mother's younger sister. So she wanted to go back, and, you know, that was the big driving force of them leaving. My dad wanted to stay, but, you know, because of my mother, he went back. And it was just me and my brother. We had already had an apartment, and it was the same apartment. But, you know, when they left, and my brother and I just took it over. And he got a job, and, you know, they left me a little bit of money when they left. And I had met some people in the apartment complex that we lived in and down at the pool. And that's how it began. They were selling cocaine. And I had never even done cocaine until I got, you know, at that point in time.
Right.
You know, I'd already started smoking pot, and that was about it, really. And I started doing that after I was kind of rehabbing after the surgery and recovering. You know, I couldn't ride my motorcycle, and so, you know, I started experimenting with the weed. But, so I started selling blow with some guys that I met in the apartment complex, and was making a lot of money, especially for a 17-year-old guy that I was at the time.
You met a guy named Joey Tassone, and was a pizza chef, and you became fast friends. Your friend Larry got strung out, you said, and that led to another guy named Craig, and then he started doing speedball. So a lot of these people, they imparted too much.
Yeah, that's
part of it. They spent too much on
the
product.
That's kind of the nature of the business. Go ahead.
So you talked about Joey introducing you to Jerry Costanza in late 1978. Who else did you meet at that time? And tell us about that meeting with Jerry Costanza and who he was.
Yeah, Jerry was, Joey had talked about him quite a bit before I actually met him, and the whole Costanza family that he, you know, got involved with. Nick being the father, and Elaine was his daughter, and Jerry and Michelle and Nikki Jr., and that was the Costanza family. And I met all of them, and, you know, they kind of became, sort of my Las Vegas family,
right,
so to speak. And but I hadn't met Jerry. I actually had met Elaine prior, you know, before I met Jerry. And Jerry was a pimp. He was a coke dealer. He'd been out there for a long time. So he was a street guy, but he was a pimp and a drug dealer, and he was, you know, pretty well connected in the street. And I met him because my connection had kind of dried up. Like you said, he got strung out doing speedballs and mixing the heroin and the cocaine. And that's something I never did. I never put a needle in my arm. That was where I drew the line. Back in my day, that was a stigma attached to that. And that was someplace I never wanted to go. And so anyway, that's what I was looking to get a new connect. And Joey had warned me about Jerry, saying that he had gotten, you know, he gets good stuff, but he was just, he'd burn you. He would burn you if he could. You know, he'd feel you out, and if he would see how much you knew, and if he determined that you didn't know anything, then that's when he would put the screws to you. But I showed him that I wasn't. I showed him, I kind of impressed him with my knowledge. You know, I tested it in front of him. I did a bleach test in front of him. And you know, I was very respectful. I mean, I was kind of intimidated by him initially because I'd heard so much about him from Joey. But him and I kind of had a chemistry, and we, you know, he was a very funny guy. He could be. He was just a character, and he was very funny. And we had, you know, we just kind of hit it off and formed a business relationship.
You talked about, you write about dealing weed, but you also were lining up jobs or scores, as you write about Laura at the bank. What did you ask of Laura, and tell us a little bit more about this sideline that you had other than dealing drugs?
Well, that was prior to. That was in Colorado, was where that all took place, in my hometown. Okay. And we were coming back, we were going back and forth, you know, to Colorado. I would go back and, you know, move some product back there. But at that time, prior to us going out or coming back to Vegas in June of 80, when I met Frank and the Hole in the Wall gang, and we'll get to that, but the deal with the girl at the bank was just kind of a fluke, actually. We had met her at I'd met her at a friend's house, and we just started partying and, you know, talking, and she mentioned the guy at the bank, and we just kind of ran with it. So it wasn't anything that we were really doing, you know. It was just we saw it as an opportunity, and like I said, we just ran with it. It was something we weren't doing regularly. I just wanted to say that.
Right. You write about the state of Las Vegas in terms of for the mobsters and for law enforcement in the 70s. In Las Vegas, and your co-author of this book, Dennis Griffin's book, The Battle for Las Vegas, chronicles, and he had written extensively about the Hole in the Wall gang. Tell us a little bit about that state of where both parties were at that time in Vegas.
When I met them in the summer of 1980, was the first week in June. It was after the failed attempted heist in Pueblo, and we went straight to Vegas. I mean, right after that happened, we hit the highway and we were in Vegas the next day. And at that time, Gene Smith, who was Sergeant Eugene Smith of the Las Vegas Metro Intelligence Division, had shot one of the mobsters, Chicago mobsters, a guy by the name of Frankie Bluestein. In front of Sunrise Villas. They had tailed him. They were constantly surveilling the upper crust, and anytime a new car was out of state plates would pull in that parking lot, they knew about it. And so Groover and Gene Smith followed him one night after he'd left the restaurant, and as Gene Smith tells me later, they weren't even going to pull him over. They were just running his plate. But he takes off down Flamingo, I believe, going like 80, 90 miles an hour. And so they had to pull him over. And that's what happened. They pulled him over in front of Sunrise Villas, and he pulled a gun on him. I know it's in the movie Casino, they say, it was a hero sandwich, but that wasn't the case. It was, in fact, the gun was registered to his brother. And anyway, he pulls the gun on Smith and Groover, and they shot him 15 times and killed him. And so those guys, when I pulled up to the restaurant in June of the first week in June, they were all abuzz about that because it had just happened. I don't know whether it was the day before or a couple of days, but it was very, you know, fresh. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they were a buzz about that, as well as they pumped me and Joe about Nick Costanza's youngest son being killed. a few months prior, they found him in the trunk of his car in the desert, shot in the back of the head. And so Nick and Jerry were beside themselves over it. I mean, they were a very close-knit Italian family. And so they wanted to pump me and Joe and got real serious with us. Pretty scary, actually. And, I mean, we didn't know anything. I mean, we were good friends with Nikki. And in fact, we had gone horseback riding with him just after we'd left to go to Colorado, right prior to that. But it was pretty intense. But that was how the first meeting went with the Hole in the Wall gang guys.
Now let's explain for our audience that for those that have seen Casino, which is everybody probably, Frank Rosenthal, right. Frank Lefty Rosenthal, is partners with Tony Spilotro. How does Frank Colada come to be? How's he connected to Spilotro? And tell us a little bit about that, as you explain.
Yeah, it was a completely different relationship. The relationship that Spilotro and Rosenthal had was a secret relationship. Everyone knew they had it, but they tried to, you know, not be seen in public together. And when they met, it was very clandestine because they didn't want that association to be, you know, proven, actually. But anyway, Colada was his street lieutenant. He was his muscle. And that's what he brought Frank out there for and assembled these guys who later became known as the Hole in the Wall gang, the Larry Newman, the Ernie DeVino, Leo Guardino, Wayne Metecky. But mainly the real Hole in the Wall gang was Ernie DeVino and Leo Guardino. Anybody else, like the picture that everybody sees of when they were arrested at Bertha's, that's the Hole in the Wall gang. But there was three guys involved in that weren't, you know, involved in, that was probably the only job they were involved with. So.
And the person you knew
Frank was the leader of the Hole in the Wall gang, which was a burglary crew. They were professionals, Ernie and Leo, and they would get tips and information from people all over Las Vegas, and they would pound holes in the side of the wall in certain jobs. Sometimes they did things differently. But and that's who they were, and they weren't even supposed to be. The bosses in Chicago would have never okayed that because it creates heat, and they didn't want anything disturbing the skin or you know, bringing heat down on people.
You talk about Elaine working at this upper crust restaurant, and it's owned by Frank Colada. And next door to the restaurant's a bar called My Place, a hangout for Spilotro.
Yes.
You're the person that you knew in the Hole in the Wall gang was Ernie. You didn't know anyone other than Ernie, and Ernie was instrumental in you. Tell us how you become involved with the Hole in the Wall gang and in what capacity.
Well, right after we arrived into town, as I talked about earlier, my friend Joe Tassoni took over Jerry Costanza's spot as the chef at the upper crust almost immediately. So I was spending a lot of time down there. I mean, I did know, like I said, I saw Frank all the time. I talked to Frank, but it was never, you know, about crime or pulling jobs. As you said, Ernie was my guy in that group. And that was mainly because him and Jerry had become tight, him and Jerry Costanza.
Mm-hmm.
And so through Jerry and, you know, Ernie and I became tight. But yeah, Ernie, I gave them a couple of scores. The first one, they almost got arrested by the police. I mean, it wasn't nothing that I had done. I had not, at that time, you know, was not working with the police. I was, you know, totally legit, straight with the Hole in the Wall. But I gave them this score, and they posed as police officers, Ernie and Leo, and we had hit this guy like 2 years before. Broken into his house because I was selling blow to him, and he was a dealer at the MGM Grant. And we discovered that he had a safe in his place. So, you know, we weren't that sophisticated. And so we just let it go. And, but then, you know, a couple of years down the road, this is when I met the hole in the wall. This is the first score that I gave them. And so they went in and they knocked on the door and the guy answered the door and they flashed badges. And as soon as, you know, he opened the door, they, you know, bum rushed him and were tying him up in a chair, and you know, we're going to get the safe combination out of them. But the neighbors saw what was going on, the neighbor across the street, and called 911. Well, Frank was driving around with the police scanner. He heard the call come across, and so he radioed Ernie and Leo to get out of there, that the cops had been called, and they ended up running up the street and hiding in somebody's house that they knew up there until Frank could get up there and get them. And I was pretty worried about that because I found out about it by, I was sitting with Jerry and Joe and we had the TV on and the news came on and it came over the news as a potential hostage situation at this address. And I'm like, we just looked at each other and immediately my pulse went up because I thought, you know, they would blame me for some reason, you know, even mm-hmm. though, you know, there really wasn't anything, that I told them exactly what the deal was. But nevertheless, I mean, I knew these guys were killers and, you know, I didn't want to be on their wrong side. So finding out if I was still cool with them was important to me, which I was. And they kind of laughed about it, actually. And then we went on to the next one.
Tell us about this score when you meet Nikki's cousin, Tommy Amato. You say this Quaalude freak here. But you had asked him about if he knew any. Tell us what you asked him and what he turned you on to.
Yeah, we were just, you know, I'd run into Tommy every once in a while. And you know, I just threw out there, you know, if he knew anybody, you know, any dealers that, you know, that we could, that, you know, throw to the hole in the wall game. And he mentioned this Cuban that he got his Quaaludes from. And the guy's name was Ernesto. And so we basically set him up. Joe and I sat on him one night. And he went to this restaurant in Las Vegas, and we just, like I said, sat in the parking lot and sat on him while Ernie and Leo went over and hit his apartment. And initially, we were told by Franks that they got like an ounce of blow and 1,000 ludes. And as we found out a little bit later from Ernie telling Jerry, they got a whole lot more than that. So that's where the rub began right there.
Now, when you realize and you find out that you've been ripped off, what is your plan and who goes along with this plan with you?
Well, I mean, honestly, when I found out initially, it was like, well, what am I going to do? That was my initial reaction. I mean, what am I going to do? Go over and, you know, strong arm these guys? And then, and honestly, that's how it was. But then Jerry came over and he started kind of priming me and, you know, getting me fired up about it and, you know, saying, hey, Dave, you know, it was your score. You know, it's up to you. You do what you want. But I know where the stuff is at. And if you want to go get it, you know, let's go get it. He says, I'll drive you over there. I can tell you exactly where it's at. And he did. And it was a house that Frank had rented for Elaine and her kid. And it was over off of the Durante Street, which was over by where Liberace used to live. It's only Liberace's house was only a couple blocks away. It's a total bad neighborhood now because I'm actually out in Vegas right now, but I went by there about a year or so ago, and it's downgraded quite a bit. But that's where we went. We drove over there in his sister Michelle Camaro, and I got to, you know, he lets me out, and it was a bathroom window that I was to go through, and it was some louvered glass pane, and I pushed one of them to break it, and it broke, but it left a jagged edge, and I caught the bottom of my arm, or my bottom of my forearm, by my elbow, actually, and I gashed it pretty good. But, I mean, I just, you know, it didn't even faze me at the time because, you know, I'm breaking into some killer's house, and you know, that's what's on my mind. So I managed to get into the bathroom, and I hear this drip, drip, and I'm over the sink, and I think it's the sink dripping. And it's pitch black. I couldn't see a damn thing. And so as soon as I rolled into the bathroom, I flip on the light, and there was just, my blood was everywhere. And that just kind of freaked me out. And I looked down, and my arm was just, you know, gushing blood. And it's, yeah. You know, so I was like Jesse Ventura and Predator. I was like, I ain't got time to bleed. And so I just kind of, boom, went right to where he told me it was, which is under a dresser drawer in a pillowcase. And he also said, if there's anything else there, Dave, leave it behind. He says, don't. If there's anything else, just take the dope. Now, I mean, I really didn't think at the time, but that don't make a lot of sense, you know. But I really didn't care. It was like we were driving over there to do it. So it's like, whatever. But there was a bag of jewelry with probably, you know, who knows how much money worth of jewelry in there, with watches and necklaces and rings and just and a lot of it. It was in a gallon Ziploc bag. And I picked it up. If I hadn't cut my arm, I probably would have stuffed it down my pants and taken it. But like I said, cutting my arm was the wild card in the whole thing. And that's what happened. I opened the door, went outside, and Jerry was sitting out there waiting. And I jumped in the car, and we took off.
Now, what do you guys go do, even though you know Frank is likely going to suspect Jerry and yourself, number one? So what do you guys do? Play it safe?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, Dan, I think the biggest reason Jerry, you know, got me to go do that was right. He just wanted to get high. He that's really, it sounds crazy or stupid, but that's what it was. And so we immediately started freebasing. We went and we hid the car, my car, and got a hotel room down at the end of the strip. We called our girlfriends up, who were both waitresses at the Pepper Mill, and the party was on. And we went on this long 2-week, as I described in the book, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas trip, where Jerry just got completely strung out, you know, with all that blow, and he was, you know, drinking to take the edge off the blow, and he just, you know, fell apart basically. And that combined with his dad calling him every day, you know, we were on the road, but Jerry would call in his dad, and then Nick would bust his balls about, you know, what we did, and telling him that we got to give it back, you know. So this was what was going on. And Jerry ended up giving something back to him. We ended up giving him back what they said Frank had told them they initially got, which was against my advice, and I thought it was the dumbest thing in the world. But it was, you know, I told Jerry, it's, you know, you go ahead, but I'm sure as hell ain't going to that meeting. So he went there with Nick, and I guess Frank slapped him around a little bit, and that was that.
So this idea of giving the money back, and it was given back, and you guys had done most of it, or a lot of it anyway, incredible amount of it, and
yeah.
spent money like you mm-hmm. like you were rich and wealthy.
Right.
What's the conversation that turns the tide and you have a radical reversal in your decision making?
Yeah, well, we after that had happened, Jerry had been planning to go to Houston, Texas, to manage a strip club down there called the Bunny Club, which was on Bissonnette Street in Houston. And he had a good friend. This guy's name was Bob Burney. And Bob would fly into Vegas, periodically, and, him and Jerry would party and whatnot. But Bob was doing some pretty good serious smuggling out of Mexico. And so Jerry had told me then and Joe that, well, we'll go down to Houston and I'll hook you up with Bob and then you guys can run blow back to Colorado. Well, that never happened. Okay, after all the dope from the score was gone and the money was gone, Jerry owed me probably about $10,000 because he had bought a new car, borrowed money from me for that, for the down payment, a Mazda RX-7. Limited edition, it was a black and gold, mm-hmm. nice, brand new car, which is what he drove to Houston in. And then and he was spending this Quaalude money, the money that we were getting from our guy, moving the lewds while we were on our road trip. We left him a few thousand, and then we'd come back into town, and then he would give us the money. And we kept the Quaaludes in a safe deposit box at one of Jerry's friends, Bob Minette's bank. And so we'd go to the bank and pick them up, and I'd take them over to my friend George, and then George would move them. So Jerry owed me a bunch of money. He just started acting weird and kind of distant. His attitude completely changed when we got down to Texas. And I noticed it big time, so did Joe. We actually thought maybe he was setting us up to get whacked. And I felt very vulnerable down there. When I would go over across the street to the bar in this dark strip club, I could envision somebody walking in and blowing me away. And so I just felt uneasy. And the fact that he owed me all that money, it was just everything came to a head down there. And I ended up having to sell my car. And it was just, I was over it all. And I was over all the people, the Costanzas and the Coladas and the whole bunch of them. And after, being around them for that entire summer and into the fall, I got a good glimpse at who they all were. And it wasn't the type of people that I wanted to, they lied. They tell you that, they borrow money. They don't pay it back, put you in, bad situations. It's just it was a decision that I just said, I'm going to the police and I'm going to squash all of them. That's what I told Joe. And we flew back into Vegas, and that's how it began.
Let's use this as an opportunity, David, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Talkspace. The people around us make a huge impact on our lives. And life's pressures can cause those relationships to change, for better or worse. Especially in light of the last 18 months, frustration can grow when dealing with friends, family, or your partner. Whether you're having complicated feelings about a relationship or just need a neutral person to talk to, Talkspace Online Therapy connects you to a licensed professional to help you work through it. From the privacy of your own home, you can speak with a professional therapist at Talkspace to set goals with your Talkspace therapist and develop techniques to cope in these difficult times. It is the number one online therapy platform. There are thousands of licensed therapists available for you to match with across dozens of specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more. If you need a little support to help you get through the end of the year or want to start building towards a better upcoming year, Talkspace is here to help. Match with a licensed therapist when you go to Talkspace.com and get $100 off your first month with the promo code TRUEMURDER. That's $100 off when you use code TRUEMURDER at Talkspace.com. Now, David, you said you made the very difficult decision, but you were very determined. So you mentioned earlier in the book that the FBI had their Vegas office, and there were certain people there, certain detectives and agents, pardon me, that were there. Who did you contact? Who did you speak to? And what did you tell them?
Well, the first contact was with Las Vegas Metro Police Secret Witness Line, which was their anonymous tip line. I figured that would be a good way to just break the ice and, you know, feel them out. I had made the decision to go to Metro over the FBI because I really didn't trust the feds, I'll be honest, and that was my decision. I felt more comfortable going to the locals. And so I contacted, the first person I spoke to was a Detective Nage Palmer, and he ran the secret witness program. And and the first thing I said to him was, today's your lucky day. And he kind of laughed and said, yeah, well, what, well, why? And I went on to tell him that I had spent the entire summer with Frank Collada and Ernie DeVino and Leo Gardino and the hole-in-the-wall gang and had enough information to take them all down. And so, you know, at that time, the Metro Police and FBI had absolutely nothing, no cases, nothing on Frank Collada or Tony Spilotro, either one. And it wasn't for lack of trying. They were spending millions of dollars and had constant 24-hour, 24/7 surveillance, wiretaps, the whole nine yards, but they didn't have anything on them. And so I kind of just ran them through, you know, the first score that I gave them, that I described earlier about where they posed as police officers.
Right.
I told them that I had ripped off Collada, and that was one of the reasons why I was coming forward, because rather than kill him, because I'm not a killer and I don't, I respect human life, but I knew I had to get rid of him for what I had done if I ever wanted to, you know, sleep soundly and not have to worry, you know, down the road. And I took it very seriously. And I pretty much said, you know, I'm going to do whatever I have to do for however long I have to do it until I put this dude away. And so after about a week or so, I talked to my friend. And so I called up one day, and this was probably a week after I initially contacted him. And Palmer told me that I would now be calling and speaking to Gene Smith.
Right.
The one who shot Frankie Bluestein. Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of made me feel at ease, because I knew from being around those guys that Gene wasn't dirty, okay? And at that point in time, that was my number one concern coming forward, because, you know, I knew about Joe Blasco, and I didn't know if they had anybody else that was still in the department that Spilotro had in his back pocket. And so that was a major concern of mine, that I wasn't walking into a, you know, getting whacked out. But when he told me Gene Smith, I kind of felt at ease, because I knew for a fact that Gene wasn't dirty from the way the mobsters talked about him when I was around him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's who I started to call. So as soon as I called him, he gave me his number, and we set up a meet. And I ended up meeting him at a Denny's, the Denny's right by the cop shop back then, which was close to downtown. And I met, and Gene pulled up, and he had a white Bonneville. And I jumped in, and he saw me. Now, remember, I'm only 19. And I shook his hand. I says, "I'm not what you expected, was it?" He kind of looked at me and smiled and laughed. He said, "No, not really." And we had an epic drive where, you know, I told him what I had, and I told him that Frank had a house full of stolen shit, furniture, that was still there, that they had done from a burglary that summer. And I was knew for a fact that it was there because right. Tommy Amato told me, and he helped move it in. So I told him that. So a couple of weeks passed, and they still hadn't moved on it. And so I met him again, and I really pressed him. And I, you know, I told him, "Look, man," I said, "I don't have time. You guys got to, you're going to blow this. You got to move on it." And that's when he told me, he says, "Well, kid," he says, "here's the deal." He says, "I got to get a search, prepare a search warrant affidavit. And I've never used you before as an informant." He says, "I believe you. But he says, "I'm going to have to fudge this warrant a little bit and say that you were, you know, that you were a confidential, reliable informant in order to get Judge McGrory to sign this thing." So that's what they did. I flew back to Colorado, and I told him that because it was around Thanksgiving. It was just a few days before Thanksgiving. And I told him that I was flying back to be with my family. And I said, "But Joe will be out here." And I says, "He's, you know, out here to take care of anything if we, you know, whatever happens, or you need to pass on any messages." And sure enough, as soon as I got back to Colorado, they hit Collada. They came in with a search warrant, and the furniture that I had told them was there. And they were real happy. That was the turning point right there. That bust was the beginning of the end for the Chicago outfit in Las Vegas.
Now let's talk about, I'll mention it. What you told the authorities was that the stolen furniture would be a good pressure for Collada, because this would likely be his three strikes and considered life in prison for this furniture. And as a result, you also told them, or these authorities, that would pressure him into even Tony Spilotro thinking that he might rat out, putting a price on his head. Tell us the predictions that you make that you're vindicated later on when you find out, but tell us the predictions you made to the authorities.
Yeah, I told Gene Smith that Halloween night as we drove around, and he showed me, he had the Nevada Black Book with him, which I thought was pretty interesting. I got kind of strange, actually, and he handed me that Black Book, and he said, "All right, I want, show me who you know in here." But anyway, I go through it, and at the end of the conversation, I told him, "Look, this is a slam dunk case. The furniture's there. He's a two-time convicted felon. He's, like you just said, he's looking at three felony convictions. Not only that, but he's under constant 24-hour surveillance. They're looking to nail him. You know, he's public enemy number two behind Tony Spilotro." So, you know, I told him all that. And you know, the cops were being cops. He knew it too, but he didn't want to let me know that how important it was, you know, or how important I was. And I told him that I had sized up Collada, and because of the drugs that he was doing with the coke, he started dating Elaine Costanza. In fact, he was dating her, you know, when we got into town. And he eventually ended up marrying her. But anyway, that was the deal. I said, if he's looking at life in prison, he'll flip. And when I told Gene Smith that initially, he kind of laughed. He basically laughed at me and, you know, looked at me like, "Well, kid," he says, "I don't know." He says, "These outfit guys are pretty hardcore." I mean, I still remember that's exactly what he said. And I said, well, that's true. But I said, I'm telling you, when they're looking at life in prison, living the life that they're living now, we'll see. And I said, he's not going to flip right away, mind you. I said, but when he runs out of rope and he runs out of road, and when it gets down to, you know, he has to make a decision, that's when it'll happen. And he kind of just blew it off, like, well, we'll, you know, we'll see. But, yeah, that's exactly what I told him.
Let's stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talk about the idea that you're going to make this deal, but what were you expecting in terms of compensation, and what was your idea initially that you wanted to get out of this deal? What was your idea and what was their idea?
Well, see, that was what was like a fluid situation. I mean, what I wanted was very simple. I wanted, I didn't necessarily want to go into the witness protection program. I wanted enough money to relocate myself to another city in return for giving them Collada. And I don't think that was asking for much, you know, just the, what I had down the road as we get further down into the book after I, you know, they fly me out and I testify, where that's really where the negotiations took place was between me and Don Campbell after I testified on May the 5th on Jerry Costanza on the drug cases that I built. But and that's when Campbell asked me, he says, well, do you want to go into witness protection? See, the thing that people have to remember, what makes my situation pretty unique, is that, see, they had nothing on me. I didn't get busted for anything. I had no charges at all initially when I came in and, you know, gave them and they busted Collada. I mean, I had no felony record. I had no priors and I wasn't charged with anything. So they couldn't control me. Now, your average mafia informant or witness is somebody that they busted and, you know, he's ratting on his friends and it's that type of thing. But that wasn't the case, and it caused a problem with them from the get-go. And for the simple fact that they couldn't control me. You know, if I got pissed at them, I'd take off and they wouldn't hear from me for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, as you'll find, when you're reading the book, I go up to Canada. Yeah. But that, when it all came down to it, that was the deal. And I told Campbell, no, I don't want witness protection because it meant you can't talk to your family or anything. I wasn't going to do that. I'm 20 years old for crying out loud. And, I told them all I need is money and a contact number in case I needed them for something. But I wanted to, you know, all I wanted was enough money to move and get, you know, have enough money to get started on someplace else. And that was that. And I told them, if you need me to testify, I'll be more than happy to testify for you.
Were you allowed to still conduct criminal activity?
When I was working with them?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wasn't, you know, in their face with it, but I had a rental car that I'd rented in Colorado that, you know, that I never took back. And I drove around in that, it was a black LTD. All
right.
Summer long, and I would meet with Gene Smith when we would go, as we later, you know, they wanted me to get back into Jerry because Jerry came back from Houston. And so during the summer, spring and summer of 1981, that's what I did. I met Jerry in May, and, you know, they wanted me to hang some drug buys on so we could leverage Collada. I didn't want to do it. I told him, you know, what had happened, how I'd taken his pawn tickets to his jewelry before I'd left. We had the altercation with his dad, as you'll read about in the book, which was one of the most craziest nights of my life. And I've had a few of them, but that was probably in the top five for sure. And it was, you know, I didn't want to do it, but it was, to me, if it meant, okay, I'll get back in the jury and do some controlled drug buys on them, if it'll end this thing, you know, if you can pull the plug on me and I can get out of this. And so that's what I did. And we had told them, that since Jerry and Elaine were so tight and the Costanza family was so tight, that especially now, remember, he's already got the possession of stolen property charge on him, and Bertha's hadn't happened yet on July the 4th of 81. So hanging drug cases on his brother-in-law with all the other things that I had done to him was going to put him pretty much in checkmate. And so that's why that was done.
What happens in terms of your prediction about the contract on Frank Collada from Tony Spilotro?
Well, I mean, I knew that all along. You know, that was just something, you know, that was a bonus, that the more heat that I put on him, that even if he didn't flip, they'd probably end up, you know, whack one or the other, he'd get whacked out. Once Tony thought he was, a liability. And it was the story that they've told Collada and the FBI is that he was played a tape of some outfit guy telling Tony Spilotro to clean his dirty laundry. Well, I don't know if that is true or not. I seriously doubt it. The reason Collada flipped was because on May the 4th, and I was back, I had gone back to Colorado, because again, they were just dragging their feet. I had done those controlled drug buys on Costanza, and they were just sitting on the table. And I kept getting bullshitted by Arnoldy, when I would call him, and Gene Smith, that, well, Campbell's tied up on another case, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. It was always something, you know, just to string me along. So finally, after what happened was Collada got convicted on April 24th of 1982 on my possession of stolen property charge.
Mm-hmm.
So he had gotten out. See, this is something else that most people don't know because they lied about it. Collada was out on $100,000 bond on my case, on the possession of stolen property case. Okay, that happened in November of 1980. Now, Bertha's doesn't happen until July 4th of 81. So he's already out on $100,000 bond when he gets cracked because of Sal Romano and Bertha's, Sal Romano setting them up on the Bertha's thing, all of them. And so the judge revokes his $100,000 bond and combines the two cases and sets his bond at $1 million. Well, he didn't get out right away, and Tony didn't come up with any money. He sat in jail from probably the July 4th until it was in the fall. He did a couple of months down in jail. And then he bonded out because, and I write about this in my book, Gene Smith calls me. And he says, do you know anybody that Collada knows up in Mount Charleston? And I thought, and I said, no. And I said, I'll ask Joe, but I don't think so. I've never heard him mention things. But it was this woman that he knew. And she put up her house and some cash, I guess, and he got out in late fall of 81. Most people don't know that. They think, because, like I said, they lied about it, the FBI and Collado lied about it, basically saying that he was in jail when they played him this tape. Now, he might have been in jail because they might have revoked his bond on April 24th when he got convicted of finally got convicted on the possession of stolen property. But so anyway, he was in a bad spot. And so they bring me in on May the 4th. And remember, it hadn't been announced that he had flipped and become a government witness. Okay.
Right.
And when I was flown out there on May the 4th, nobody was acting like Frank Collado had become a government witness. In fact, they knew exactly what I was being brought out there for. And that was to testify before this Federal Strike Force grand jury, along with Detective Cordell Pearson, who I did the control buys on Costanza with, that were all filmed and I had a wire on and the whole nine. And that's what I did. They guarded me 24/7. I was guarded like the president. I was taken to the federal building in the back door, and then I testified to what I did. And that's when I had the meeting with Campbell about the witness protection and getting paid and all that. But what ended up happening was they sent me back to Colorado because Campbell told me, he says, you know, otherwise I got to tie up a whole unit of guys to, you know, sit on you and guard you. And I don't think you want that. So he says, why don't you, we'll fly you back to Colorado. As soon as we go and round these guys up, we'll fly you back and then we'll get you your money and get you, you know, you disappear. Well, as soon as I flew back to Colorado, the next day, I mean, I'm on pins and needles, which you can imagine, right? My whole life's right. Getting ready to change. I mean, I'm 21 years old at this point, just turned 21 actually. And I don't get a phone call from any of them. And days start clicking by and still nothing about Collado flipping. Then all of a sudden I get the phone call. I don't know if it was a few days or a week later. Meanwhile, I'm calling Arnoldy, Campbell, Gene Smith. I'm blowing their phones up out in Las Vegas, okay? And none of them are returning my calls. So you imagine what I'm thinking.
Right.
So here's the next thing. Joe Tassone calls me up in Las Vegas. He says, hey, Dave, guess what? It's all over the news. They just announced Frank Collado has become a government witness. And now this happened, I got the newspaper article. I think it's May the 19th, okay, is when they announced it. I'm sure he flipped before, you know, they waited a few days after he flipped before they announced it. So just to give you the timelines, because I contend that it was everything that I did on Frank Collado that caused him to flip, and especially the final testifying against Jerry and also his cousin Lewis. And there was about three or four of the people who went along with Jerry on those buys. And so there was like five people on the indictment. And I mean, Jerry knew a lot himself. So what happened was they took those indictments over to Frank and Elaine and said, it's all over, Frank. And that's pretty much what happened.
Right.
And that's when he decided to flip.
Yes. Let's stop for a commercial break. Now, we have to talk about how you were dissatisfied with the deal with the U.S. State Attorney for Nevada, Don Campbell, and eventually you realized you're getting screwed over, and you weren't going to get your money. You weren't going to get your credit. There was a story. There was something in the media. It was a four-part series that was produced. But at the end of it, you were still disappointed that the story wasn't really told. Your story really wasn't told. And then you saw, again, all the books that came out, again, that you weren't even mentioned. So it was like you never really existed, and the work that you did, this crucial, important work to bring down Spilotro and the hole-in-the-wall gang, without you, they wouldn't have done this whatsoever. you wanted credit. So how do you meet Dennis Griffin? And tell us about this journey to get your story told.
Well, going back to right after they burned me is when, after Joey had told me that on the phone, I told my father this, and, you know, Joe and I talked about it, and Vince and I talked about it. And so I flew out there, and on my own dime, you know, not protected, and basically just barged into the U.S. Attorney's office and told Don Campbell, you know, WTF, you know, what the, you know what, what's going on? I know Frank's flipped, and I know why he flipped, and now why haven't I heard from him? Well, it was the most surreal experience I've ever experienced in my life. And it I'll never forget it, because here are these people who had, you know, fallen all over me and treated me, you know, and realized how important I was and the work that I was doing for them. And then all of a sudden, as soon as they got Collada, because of me, when I flew back out there, it was like 180 degrees turnaround in their attitude. I mean, they basically just treated me like a piece of dirt. And it's like, kick rocks, kid, get lost. You know, we got what we wanted out of you, and so just go get killed. And, I mean, I had people want, you know, remember, those indictments. And well, first thing I asked him was, what happened to the indictments on Cassandra? What, I just came out here and testified, remember? You guys guarded me 24/7. And you know, and then you don't answer my calls. And then I find out from Joe that Collada flips, and here I am. And it's, well, he gives me this BS story. Well, the grand jury wouldn't return the indictments. And I just looked at him like, dude, I'm only 21, but I'm not that dumb, okay? And part of the deal was for them that Frank would cooperate and become a government witness if those indictments that I had just gotten on Jerry and Lewis and the rest of them were dismissed. That was part of the deal from the get-go. And the second part of the deal was that David Bowman would never be mentioned from this point further. So I'm telling you, it was a surrealist thing. I've never seen people act the way Campbell acted. And then I went over and had a big confrontation with Gene Smith and Kent Clifford of Intelligence after Campbell had threatened to have me arrested by federal agents. I called him on the phone to ask him something after the initial meeting. And he jumped in my ass, and he's telling me, oh, I'm going to have you arrested by federal agents for paying, because he gave me like basically enough money to buy a plane ticket back to Colorado. And he was going to have me arrested by federal agents because for obtaining federal funds under false pretenses. Well, you can imagine what I told him. You'll read about it in the book when he told me that on the phone. And so I go to the media, I went to all the television stations. I met with Gwen Castaldi and her producer with the NBC affiliate. I spoke to Ned Day, who had written a lot of stuff on Spilotro with CBS, and he also wrote for the RJ. But I ended up doing the story with Jeff Gurman of the Las Vegas Sun. And it was almost immediately after they burned me, I went to the media, right? And I told the feds that and the police that I was going to the media and I was going to blow the whole thing up. And I didn't care, and that's what I did. The story never came out, Dan, until September. I believe it was September 19th of 82. Now, remember, I got burned in May. So it took them months to scrub this story because the Costanzas weren't under indictment for anything at that point, so they couldn't use their names, so they had to change their names in the story. And that's why I was disappointed in the final product that came out, the four-part series. I mean, it was a huge story. But here's something that's very relevant that people need to know. That as soon as my story was released, which was a Sunday, was when the first part broke. Front page of the Las Vegas Sun. The very next day, that following Monday, guess what happened? The Las Vegas FBI and Frank Collada collaborate on a story, a front page story, and the RJ, the competing newspaper, saying, here all of a sudden it's Collada, he's a federal witness, right? And here all of a sudden he's doing a front page news story with the FBI's blessing, which is pretty weird to begin with, but it was all done to deflect attention away from my story, because they ran that story the following Monday. And I never forget, I called Jeff Gurman and he told me that. He said, Dave, you're never going to believe this. He says, they ran a story with Collada saying that he paid off the sheriff-elect at the time, John Moran, because the elections were coming up in November for sheriff. And John McCarthy was running against John Moran. McCarthy was the incumbent. They were the bunch that I worked with, Gene Smith, Kent Clifford, and John McCarthy. That was McCarthy's regime. And Moran was his opposition. So Collada come up with a story that he bribed Moran $40,000 so he would stay off of Tony and him, which John Moran later took a polygraph. There was a whole bunch of stories that followed that, because it set off a shitstorm basically in the media. That just went on and on and on for weeks after that. Moran called him a pathological liar, and I mean, it got really ugly. But Moran did take a polygraph. Bottom line is, Dan, the whole story was completely fabricated by Collada, by the FBI, to not only smear Moran, but mainly to deflect attention away from my story and how they burned me.
Right. Now let's get to Colorado Springs. Your brother has a business and you start working a regular job. And mm-hmm. you rent a house with your old friend Vince Spotto. And along with his wife, who's a dancer. And you meet a dancer named Melinda Molly Derwigger. Tell us about her. Okay, sorry. Tell us about her personal situation and relationship and how you got involved.
Well, like you said, I'd gone back to Colorado after all the Las Vegas stuff. I started working for my brother's company up in Colorado Springs. Actually, I'd moved in to the house on Webb Drive in Colorado Springs with actually a childhood friend, and his girlfriend, and then Vince and his wife. Well, Vince came out initially, and then his wife came out a couple weeks later. He brought her out along with his son, who was just born. And, excuse me. And so, yeah, he moved in with me because after I moved back to Colorado, I quit doing blow. I wasn't partying. I was just working all the time, and I was actually just kind of bored and lonely. And, you know, Vince was having, you know, issues out in Las Vegas. And he was involved with the coke and was dealing out there. And his life was kind of coming unraveled. And he kind of wanted to be around his friend, you know, and he wanted, you know, just to get out of Vegas for a while and hang out with me for a while. So he flew back and we started frequenting this strip club, and it was kind of a real, you know, light strip club light. Okay, it wasn't a real hardcore bar, because the girl that I met, this Melinda, was 19 at the time, so it was kind of like a go-go dance club called the Candlelight Inn up on North Nevada in Colorado Springs, and it was just innocent. You know, we came in and we'd go back and shoot pool and watch the girls, and we had the coke. Vince had some blow with them, and so we kind of used that to break the ice with the dancers, and that's how I met her. And we started partying. She came over, and to the house and spent the night with me a couple times. And we would just begin getting involved in a relationship.
Tell us about the night in question that, again, once again changed your life drastically and dramatically.
Yeah, it was very unfortunate. I had gone down to the club with Vince and Shira, because Shira was going to get a job dancing there because she had just got into town. And since it was like a little go-go club, you know, Vince was cool with it. So he's like, okay. And we brought her down there, and she talked to Molly, and she was going to start working there. And then Molly and I spent a little time together, and she told me just go to her apartment, and her roommates would let me in. She'd see me after when she got off work. And I said, cool. I said, I'm going to take Vince and Shira home, and then I'll get my work clothes and head over. And that's what I did. And so it's like, it's very early in the morning, and I get over to her apartment, and she hadn't got home yet. And like she said, her roommates were there, Tracy and Mary, and there was a couple more, actually. But I didn't really know them. And so the two girls that I knew let me in, and I went into her bedroom and started getting undressed. And I had my work uniform and everything so I could get up and go to work the next day. Well, it wasn't long. All of a sudden, she opens her bedroom door and walks in. And immediately I knew, could read her face, that something was up. I mean, almost immediately. I could tell she was upset. And she just looks at me and she kind of, I could tell she was embarrassed and, you know, and she looks at me and says, Dave, I feel like such an asshole. Please don't hate me. Roger's downstairs, and he says we have to talk. And now I'm super tired. I've been doing coke. I've worked all day, okay, and then I've been up partying. I had a couple of drinks, but I'm totally exhausted. And I didn't say anything. I just looked at her. And before I could say anything, her roommate, Tracy, grabs me by my hand and says, Dave, come with me, and grabs me by the hand and takes me out of the bedroom, and we go into the bathroom. Well, this girl was shooting coke, and that was really what she wanted. She wanted a shot. So I obliged her. I loaded her up a spoon of powder and watched her do her thing. And while she's doing that, I'm asking her. I'm like, all right, Tracy, what's going on here? And she says, oh, Molly really digs you, Dave, but this Roger, he's an asshole. He won't take no for an answer. But just let Molly handle it. She wants to be with you, but let her deal with this jerk. Okay, that's basically what she told me. Well, while we were in the bathroom, this guy, this ex-boyfriend of hers, who was a DJ down at the club. Okay, he was the DJ at the Candlelight, and Molly had told me that she had dated him and it was over and blah blah. So. Anyway, while I come out of the bathroom with Tracy, he has come into the apartment and gone into the bedroom and closed the door. And I still got all my clothes and coat and keys and, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, boy, this guy has got a lot of balls to do something like this, you know? I mean, but remember, I've been through all this in Las Vegas. I've worked with the FBI, and the police. I'm upset, but I'm very much under control. And I realize, you know, what this guy's pulling. And I say to Tracy, I said, look, I said, somebody better go in there and get my coat and my stuff and my keys. I said, because if I go in there, I think, you know, it's going to be some problems. And so, boy, she was right on the Johnny on the spot. She went into the bedroom. She knocked on the door. She slid in. She came out with my coat and my keys. But she left my work uniform because I'd left it in this little wedge between the wall and the bed, which is key down the road, but I just wanted to interject that. And so I get my stuff, and I didn't leave immediately. Like, I just sat out there in the living room because I was hoping maybe he'd walk out or something. And all the while I'm processing in my head, what should I do? Should I go confront this guy? And I said to myself, Dave, he's got a gun, or he would have never did what he did, because he wasn't a big guy, okay? He wasn't big at all. So, and he knew that. That's why I figured he had a gun as boldly as he was acting. And it wouldn't do me any good to go in there, because he would just pull the gun on me, and the whole situation would then escalate. So I decided to leave. I get in my work truck, and I drive all the way back to the house. Well, on the drive back to the house, I got more pissed. You know, I just thought, boy, the balls of this guy. Who does this guy think he is, right? And so I get back to the house, and I'm kind of surprised when I walk in. Vince had gotten up, and he was getting something out of the refrigerator when I walked in. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning. Or, well, maybe about 3:30, something like that. And he was getting a drink or something. He looked at me like, what are you doing here? And I went on to tell him what had happened. And I told him, I says, give me your gun. I said, I want to go back over there and confront this idiot. And he says, no, he says, I'll go with you. I says, no, I don't want you to go with me. I says, it's none of your business. I says, let me use the gun. He says, no, he says, I want to come with you. I said, all right, dude. I said, but, you know, I'm telling you, I don't want you pulling the gun on this guy. I'm telling you, just watch my back. I'm going to confront him. I said, you know, if we get into a fight, I said, just make sure I don't, you know, get carried away on this guy. That's what I told him. And, but I said, you got to promise me you won't pull that gun. And he said, I promise you, dude. I said, good. I said, we don't need this bullshit. I said, I just want to find out, you know, if she wants to be with him, fine, but that's not what Tracy told me. I said, I'll throw his ass out of there. I said, but just watch my back. That's all I want you to do. So we go back to the apartment. Vince has the gun. He's got it stuffed down his waistband. He's got my winter jacket on, which is a heavy winter, kind of a leather jacket, which you couldn't tell that he had a gun, a .357 in his waistband. So we knock on the door. The girls let us in, but immediately they saw me and Vince, and the roommate knew, I could see it in her eyes, that she knew, you could see the fear in her eyes, that, oh, shit, this is going to be, this don't look good. So Vince and I go to the bedroom door. I knock on the door and almost simultaneously open the door, flip on the light. There, Molly and him are in bed. She's laying on the left side. He's laying on the right side. And I go to the corner of Molly's end of the bed, and Vince walks around my back, and he stands directly in front of Bird, who's laying in bed. And he's got his arms folded. And he just doesn't say a word. He just stands there. And I'm the one that talks. As soon as I flipped on the light, he lifted his head off the pillow. And I looked at him. I said, hey, you and I got something to discuss. And he looks at me and he says, F you, pick a better time. And he puts his head back down the pillow. I kind of laughed, and I said, hey, I said, you got 30 seconds to get up out of that bed and put your pants on, or I'll put them on for you. And he sits up in bed real fast and says, oh, yeah. And he reaches up on the headboard where he has his .25 semi-automatic with his clip laying right next to it. He grabs him with one hand, he pops the clip in. As soon as Vince saw him reach back there, he says, David, he's got a gun. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw Vince pirouette and turn his back and unzip his jacket. And I knew he was pulling the gun. And so he pulls the gun out of his waistband, and he comes around the corner of the bed. And by then, Berg had already leveled the gun on me. He grabs his wrist with the gun in it and jerks it straight up in the air, so if he squeezed the shot, it wouldn't shoot me. And it would go in the ceiling. And he takes the .357 and he jams it to Berg's temple and tells him, and I mean, he jammed it to his head and says, chill out, asshole. And he had him, okay? He had his wrist. He had the 357 pressed to his head. The guy, if he would have just dropped the gun, my whole life would be different, okay? But he was drunk. The autopsy showed he had all kinds of drugs. And he was heavily intoxicated. And he tried to last struggle with Vince, turn his gun on Vince. And as soon as they locked into the struggle, I leaned down because Molly was starting to, you know, get active. And she said, like, no, guys, no, or something like that. I leaned down to grab her foot because I was going to pull her, you know, out of the bed once those two locked up on each other. And they both had guns. I just wanted to, the first thing I thought was to get her out of harm's way. But as soon as I reached down to grab her ankle, the gun, Vince's gun went off. And I could see, you know, it killed him instantly. It was a pretty gross thing to see. And immediately Molly flew out of bed just screaming, you know, hysterically. And, I mean, if you're human at all, I mean, a hysterical screaming woman is something that I think gets to most people. And I understood why, you know, because we certainly didn't intend that to happen. So it was just a shock is what it was to me, because everything just happened so fast within a matter of seconds. And it was just a situation. I never should have went back over there. I mean, I sat in prison for I ended up doing an 8-year sentence over that. Vince ended up going, got convicted of first degree murder. I wasn't able to testify at his trial because they severed us. We were indicted by a grand jury. So, you know, there was a lot of legal maneuvering involved, but I gave a 32-page statement to the Colorado Springs police after I flew back and turned myself in. Sergeant Joe Kenda was actually the guy, homicide hunter Kenda.
Yeah.
And they asked me if I wanted a lawyer. I wanted to say, hell, I am a lawyer. I don't need a lawyer. Guys don't know what I've just been through in Las Vegas, but I didn't say that. I just basically told the truth. I told them exactly what I just told you and your audience as to what happened. And, I'll stand on that statement to this day is what I always tell people. The truth never changes.
Right.
And so that's pretty much what it is. What happened down the road was the case was overturned by the Colorado Court of Appeals. The state appealed the appellate court's reversal and to the Colorado Supreme Court. And the Colorado Supreme Court took the case, and we won that 4-3. Colorado Supreme Court case. It's a precedent case. It's People versus Spoto. It's a precedent case on similar transaction evidence.
Yeah,
this uses
an opportunity to stop for a commercial break. Now, you talked about after prison, after this whole thing was all sorted out, and then you decided that you needed to tell this story. And you discovered that Frank Collada was having tours of the spots in Las Vegas where some of the scenes in Casino were actually shot. So tell us what your plan was and your meeting with Frank Collada before I let you go.
Yeah, I had tried to reach him actually several times prior to this, years prior to the time when I finally did in August of 2019. I just wanted to throw that out there, and he would ignore me. So I thought about it, and I thought of how I could confront him without him giving him, a back door to run through. And like you mentioned, I found out he was doing his Frank Collada Casino tour. And so I booked a tour with him. And, of course, I didn't tell him I was David Bowman. And I knew after all these years, after 40 years, he probably wouldn't recognize me with the gray hair and all. But Anyway, that's what I did. And I went out there for the sole purpose of telling him I wanted to write a book. And I told everybody when I went out there, the people that I were working with, that I'm going out there to get a book deal. But I didn't know, but I was going to get it done. And so I booked the casino tour, and I got to admit, it was pretty nerve-wracking when I stepped into that vehicle with him and his driver. I wasn't so much worried about Frank as I was his driver, because I didn't know who this guy was, and I knew Frank was 80 years old, so there wasn't much I was worried about with him. But the first minute was pretty intense. He started talking about his thing, and I said, "Yeah, Frank, I know all about it." I says, "I'm David Bowman, secret witness 491. And as soon as I said that, he says, "Oh, you're that son of a bitch." And and then pretty much right after that, he says, "You're persistent." And I thought, "Yeah, Frank, I am." And but he knew, as soon as I told him that I was David Bowman, he knew that I was the guy that got him. Way back, like I said, when they brought the indictments to him on Jerry, they told him that I was the one that got him on the furniture, and that I was the one that got Jerry, and basically got him, period. So he actually did. Frank also did an 8-year sentence, even though he was in witness protection, on my possession of stolen property case. It wasn't Bertha's. It was the possession of stolen property that he did his 3.5 years on.
Right.
But it was a very tense, like I said, for the first minute or so. And then we had a great conversation. We talked about things that only him and I could discuss, because, you know, he knew what I knew, which was everything. And we talked about who murdered Nikki. We talked about Elena. You know, he called Elena while we were still driving around, because he knew that I was close to Elaine. I had met Elaine 2 years before he did. I mean, Elaine was kind of like a big sister to me. And so he called her up, and then, but it was after he called Elaine up, after he called Denny Griffin. He called Denny Griffin up immediately, because I told Frank, I said, "Look, I want to do a book, and I want to tell my story." And Frank knew it, and he wasn't going to object to it. I think I actually kind of scared him a little bit. I really do. We were both nervous for our own reasons. But like I said, he even told me that doing those casino tours, he worried about one of his victims, family members, coming and whacking them. Because one of the things that he, just to show you what I think is how crazy our society has become, part of his casino tour, he would drive around, or he would go to the house of the guy he murdered, this Jerry Listener, and he would describe in detail how he killed this man. And he did it to me. He told me how he did it. How he, you know, he used half loads and a .22, and he shot him in the, you know, got in the house, he shot him in the head, and the guy wouldn't go down. So, and he used half loads because they couldn't get a silencer at the time, so they had to use half loads, but they weren't enough powder to, you know, penetrate his skull, I guess. So he ends up having to strangle the guy with the water cooler electrical cord. And then Wayne Metecky came in, because Frank didn't come out right away or when he was supposed to. So Wayne came in and had another gun, and he put a pillow in his face and shot him in the face 5 or 6 times. And then they threw him in the pool, is how he describes it. They took him out back and threw him in the pool to wash off the forensic evidence. And that's where they found the guy floating in the swimming pool, Jerry Listener. Which, by the way, your listeners should know that he was given immunity, of course, for that killing. along with three others. So he was basically given immunity on four murders to become a government witness.
Now, in the end, Dennis Griffin was the author that Frank Collada told you about and had written and helped Frank Collada write his story, and also had done covered extensively the Hole in the Wall gang in books such as Battle for Las Vegas. Tell us about Dennis Griffin. We talked about this earlier. He passed away this August. Tell us just a little bit about bringing this book and getting this book done with Dennis Griffin.
Yeah, Danny, like I said, Frank called him that very, as we were driving around on his casino tour, which surprised me, by the way, as quickly as he called him and how quickly it all happened. And that's how it happened. It was just like that. And he gave me Denny's number, and after we got done with the tour, I called Denny, or he gave Denny my number. I forget what it was, but and we just immediately started talking on the phone, and he contacted a publisher who he had done other books with, I believe Frank's books, and said they were very interested, and that's what when we were going to do it. And so, but Denny was it was a total gentleman. I never met him personally. We did everything over the phone, and I wrote my manuscript, and he pretty much just edited it and put it together very nicely. And but from my impression of Denny, he was a very, what I knew of him, he was a very good man and an honest man and a very talented writer, and he did a great job with, like I said, editing my manuscript and putting it in book form, and I thought he did a great job, and it was a shock when he passed a few months ago.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you, David Bowman, for coming on and talking about your book, Bringing Down Collada, The Story Casino Couldn't Tell You. Is there a website, a Facebook page, somewhere where they might take a look at this? I know it's on Amazon, but tell us about that. If there
yeah, I've got a Facebook page, and it's Bringing Down Collada, and as well as a Twitter account, same thing, Bringing Down Collada. It's Collotta. It's kind of a sometimes that people get the spelling wrong, but and I will have my website up in a few days. In fact, I'm working on it, or was working on it before the interview. So I would say within a week I'll have my bringingdowncollotta.com up, and you'll be able to buy the book from that as well as from my publisher Coastal West, which is a Canadian publisher. You can get the book through coastalwest.ca.
Great. Thank you so much, David Bowman. It's been a pleasure. Bringing Down Collada, The Story Casino Couldn't Tell You. You have a great evening, and thank you so much for this interview. David Bowman, good night.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.